Chapter 32. They met for dinner at the Lobster Claw. The Claw had been open for a few years, but had never managed to catch on like the Gull. Jesse couldn't figure it out. The only decent food choices at the Gull were sandwiches and salads. And while the rest of the menu wouldn't put you in the hospital, the best thing you could say about their hot dishes was that they were usually hot. Jesse mentioned his confusion to Tamara. She shook her head at him. "You know, for the best cop I ever met, you sure can be thick sometimes," she said. "How so?" "It's that small town thing. You still don't get it, do you? Even after that thing with the missing girls?" "But this isn't about dark secrets. It's about a restaurant." "I agree with you, Jesse. The food's better here. But it's not about the food. It's about comfort. Small towns like their comfort. It makes them feel safe. It insulates them from out there." She gestured with both hands. "When did you become an expert on small towns? You ever see Texas on a map? Next to Alaska. There's not a better place to study small town life than in Texas. You learn that early on. The more this area becomes an extension of Boston, the harder people are going to cling to places like Daisy's and the Gull. Someday, maybe sooner than you think, this town and the others nearby will be very different places." Jesse took a sip of wine, consternation on his usually inscrutable face. "What?" Tamara asked. "Something wrong with the wine?" "The wine's okay. You're the second person in the last few days to say something like that, about how Boston would start encroaching on paradise. Something wicked this way comes. It's inevitable, I guess, with more people moving up here and commuting to the city. Who was the first person to mention the subject?" Just then, Jesse's phone buzzed in his pocket. Being chief had its perks, but they came at a price. He didn't usually have the luxury of blowing off calls. And when he saw who this particular call was from, he knew he was going to pick up. Tamara was curious. "Who is it?" "The person you were just asking about. I'll be back in a minute," he said, standing up and heading for the Lobster Claw's outside deck.
"Stone, you there?"
"I'm here, Vinny. You have something for me?"
"Maybe."
"Maybe? This is a negotiation?"
"That's up to you."
"What's it going to take, Vinny?" Jesse asked, looking out into the blackening ocean. He remembered 2 years earlier standing on the deck, just after the Lobster Claw had opened. He had a black label in his hand that night, not a cell phone. Although he had been drinking wine to appease Tamara, the prospect of bargaining with Vinny Morris was making the thought of a double black label neat, very appealing. He repeated Jesse's question.
"What's it gonna take?" "Nothing too crazy, just an understanding between us."
"What sort of understanding?"
"The same sort you have with Gino. A favor done is a favor earned."
"This wouldn't have anything to do with..." Vinny cut him off.
"Never. You got my word on that. That thing was something I did for us both, and it wasn't business. What I'm talking here is business. Good business for us both. Always worked for you and Gino."
"Until it didn't."
"Yeah, until it didn't. But that's not going to happen to us, Stone. And just to show you I mean what I say, this one's on the house. You got a pen and paper handy?"
Jesse reached into his back pocket for the notepad he'd always carried since his days in uniform in L.A., and into his front pocket for a pen. He looked around to make sure no one was in earshot, then put the phone on speaker and placed it on the deck rail.
"Shoot." "Kirk Kingston Kernut. Goes by King. Petty thief who's good at boosting cars. Last stretch was for pistol whipping a gas station attendant. Got out a few months ago. His cellmate was a clown named Humphrey Bolton."
"Hump.
See, I knew there was a reason you're chief. Word is you don't want to tangle with him. Country's strong and good with his fists. They're both in the system."
"Thanks, Vinny.
Remember, Stone, this one's on the house. Next time it's business."
"Uh-huh.
You know what I like about you, Jesse?"
"No."
"Most of the time you talk even less than me."
The phone went quiet. Jesse scrolled to Lundquist's number, but got voicemail. He left a message that included the information Vinny Morris had just given him.
Then he called the station and had Alicia look up Kernut and Bolton in the system and put together a packet for him to present to the mayor and the DA. He also had her make up two photo arrays that included the suspects. He supposed he could have had her alert the state and local authorities, but he didn't want to get ahead of himself. When Jesse got back to the table, dinner was waiting for him. Tamara, too. A brick-sized hunk of lemon-scented salmon over arugula and watercress was in front of the ME, and a skirt steak over mashed sweet potatoes was at Jesse's place. The ball of rosemary butter atop his steak had nearly melted away. Tamara took one look at Jesse and knew. She also knew it wasn't another homicide, or her cell would have gone off as well. "Don't worry," she said, waving the waitress over. "Can we have these wrapped separately to go?" "I'm sorry, Doc, it's business." "I figured. You mind telling me what's up?" He leaned over and whispered in her ear the information he'd received about the two likely suspects. She made a face halfway between a smile and a frown. When the waitress returned, Tamara said, "I'll take care of the bill. Take yours and go on and get." Jesse Stone was old school, and the thought of Tamara paying bugged him, though he knew better than to show it. Instead, he focused on something else Tamara had said. "Git? Your Texas is showing." She folded down her middle and ring fingers on her left hand, holding them down with her thumb, and raised her index finger and pinky. "Hook 'em horns. I bleed burnt orange." Chapter 33. Jesse's first stop was the station. Alicia had already done as he had asked, putting together two packets on the suspects and two photo arrays. What Alicia didn't do was ask Jesse where he'd gotten his information from. She was wise that way, and every time she displayed those good cop instincts, he felt better about hiring her instead of some old pro-city cop. Gabe Weathers was good, but he'd been on the job in Boston for only 5 years before hiring on in Paradise. The problem with who the selectman and the mayor had wanted him to hire was that retired big-city cops came with all sorts of baggage. They always knew better, and their attitudes were hardwired. You had to spend as much time untraining them as training them, and even then you couldn't beat the big city out of them. And if the last few years had taught him anything, it was that policing a small town came with different challenges. To Jesse, the savings on pension and benefits wasn't worth it. "What should I do now, Jesse?" "Call the mayor and tell her I've got two potential suspects, but that I have to talk to Rudy Walsh first." "The Mass X delivery man, to get a positive ID?"
"Exactly. Tell her honor that if Walsh IDs them, I'll be by first thing in the morning. By the way, Alicia, you've got an admirer over on Styles." She turned away from Jesse in embarrassment.
"Dylan seems like a good kid," Jesse said. "Maybe you should give him a chance." She smiled at him.
"Maybe I already have."
Jesse plucked one of the two packets on the suspects and a photo array from in front of Alicia and headed out the door. Before he'd gotten a block, the radio went off, and the ringing of a phone came through the speakers of his Explorer. It was Lundquist.
"Jesse Stone. You want to tell me where you came up with these two guys?" Lundquist asked, sounding a little bit annoyed. "We haven't gotten the DNA results back, and we didn't find a single fingerprint. You'd also be amazed at how many cons have the nicknames King and Hump. Still, somehow you found out it was these mutts."
"Does it matter how?"
"I'm on my way over to the hospital to see if Walsh can pick them out of photo arrays. Healy always said you had connections. Never bothered him, but I always wondered what price you had to pay or what you had to trade for their information."
"Healy never let it bother him too much, Brian. You've been at this long enough to know that good information doesn't come from the sunny side of the street." Lundquist let that go.
"So what's the plan if he IDs them?"
"Then I have to go to Mayor Walker with it. She'll want to do a press conference. But if Walsh IDs them, I'll give you a heads up. We can't let these guys get away because of my mayor's political aspirations."
"I'll be here."
But then he wasn't. The familiar two-tone hang-up chime sounded in the Explorer, and the music came back on. It was Terry Jester singing King to Pawn, one of Jesse's favorites.
He even caught himself singing along. Deborah Holt, the nurse in charge of Rudy Walsh's floor, was less than pleased to see Jesse Stone. They'd crossed paths before, usually when Jesse wanted to break hospital rules. "I'm sorry, Chief Stone," she said, putting her palm up to cut him off, "but Mr. Walsh is probably asleep, and his concussion symptoms haven't abated as quickly as Dr. Marks had hoped." Jesse took a deep breath. Normally, he wouldn't have pushed, but this wasn't normally. "I'm sorry, but I've got two potential murder suspects out there, the two men who put Mr. Walsh in here to begin with. I need him to make a positive ID so we can get after them." She didn't like it, and it showed. This was always the nature of her interactions with Jesse Stone. He always wanted to cut corners, but always came armed with a valid reason to do so. The last time they'd done business, she had had to help the chief sneak a man who'd been hit by a truck out of his room. "The best I can do is to call Dr. Marks. If he says you can go in, then I won't stop you." "Fair enough." Jesse waited. He could tell by the expression on Nurse Holt's face that Marks had given his blessing for him to show the photo arrays to Walsh. And if that didn't give her away, her slamming down the phone certainly did. Even her stride was angry. "The doctor says that if Mr. Walsh is awake and agrees to see you, then you are to be permitted to talk with him, but that if he is asleep or doesn't feel up to it, you are to come back in the morning. Understood?" "Uh-huh." 60 seconds later, she waved Jesse into Walsh's room. The room was dark. Jesse had had a concussion or two and knew that bright light and loud noises could trigger awful headaches. But he couldn't risk Walsh misidentifying the suspects or leaving any doubt in his identifications because the lighting was poor. So he stood beside Walsh, laid out each array on the movable food table, and shone his keychain LED flash onto the photos. He made sure to keep direct light out of Walsh's eyes. The photos were all the same size and were all in color. The subjects were all roughly the same size in the photos, the same race, and within a fair age range. Jesse had seen judges throw out IDs because the arrays had been done in such a way as to influence the witnesses' choices. Not in Paradise, not on Jesse's watch. And just to make doubly sure, he had Nurse Holt stay to confirm the IDs. "This guy was the guy who clocked me," Walsh said, pounding his index finger on Kirk Kingston Kernut's photo. "He tried to hide his face with his shirt, but it slipped off him and I got a good look. And this fella here, he's the one who tied me up." This time Walsh was pounding Humphrey Bolton's headshot. "I hope you find an excuse to shoot these two bastards." Jesse let that pass without comment. Instead, he wished Walsh a speedy recovery, thanked Nurse Holt, and left. He had calls to make and business to do.